There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred with you in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and today we've got the first of a special two-part Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest is author Sandra Nemi, who is the niece of Myla Nurmi, better known as the famed horror hostess Vampyra. Sandra's book is titled Glamour Ghoul, The Passions and the Pain of the Real Vampyra, Myla Nurmi, and it details the life of Sandra's aunt from a difficult childhood through the many ups and downs of her career as an artist. It's a career that resulted in a number of relationships with film and music icons of the 20th century, including Mae West, Orson Welles, Marlon Brando, James Dean, and Elvis Presley. In part one, we find out about her upbringing, her early days on Broadway and in Hollywood, including her brief working relationship with director Howard Hawks, her affair with Orson Welles, her relationship with James Dean, and her transformation into Vampyra, as well as her days as the reigning queen of horror hosts. During her height as Vampyra, the number one song in the land was Hey There from Rosemary Clooney, a song that was also Myla's favorite. So we'll begin with that auditory salutation, followed by part one of our Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes, love never made a fool of you. You used to be too wise. Hey there.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and my guest today for our Coolest Conversations is Sandra Nemi, the author of Glamour Ghoul, The Passions and Pain of the Real Vampyra, Myla Nurmi, who was also Sandra's aunt. How are you, Sandra?
I'm good today, yes. Thank you.
Well, where do you call home these days?
Well, for 60 years, I lived in Astoria, Oregon, which is the very, very northwest tip of Oregon, not far from the Pacific Ocean. But about 10 years ago, I moved inland to the capital of Oregon, Salem, and that's where I live now.
Well, how has this pandemic affected your world? Have your family and friends remained healthy?
They have. I'm very, very fortunate. I have one friend in Southern California who contracted the COVID on January 10th, but she had a mild case and has completely recovered, for which I'm very thankful. Yeah. But my life really hasn't changed a whole lot because I didn't do much traveling. I'm 73 years old, and so as a senior, I'm pretty much stay at home.
Well, did this pandemic weirdly help you finish the book, or was it already completed as the world went into lockdown?
It wasn't completed because I finished it in the first part of December of 2019 before the pandemic hit the U.S. Mm-hmm. But it took me 12 years to complete. I started it in 2008. Shortly after my aunt Myla passed away. Mm-hmm. And it took 12 years for me to finish it because I had graduated from college in 1969. And after 50 years out of school, I thought, you know, I've forgotten everything I ever learned. And so I was filled with self-doubt, just terrible. You know, this is terrible writing. You can't write anymore. And you know, no one's going to care anyway. But then something miraculous happened. I don't know if you want me to talk about it right now, about my cousin David, who lives in Vermont. Did I Do you know about him?
I do, and I'm going to we'll get to him actually as we move along here.
All right.
But first, as we're talking about the book, let me congratulate you on it. I hope you feel like you've done your aunt justice. Do you?
I sure hope so, because I got to thinking if I never finished this book, my aunt would only become a footnote in history. Mm-hmm. And she deserved so much more because she was an icon in the horror genre. And here I was sitting on all this information. I was the only one who had all this information. And if I didn't document it, then she would be forgotten. And I couldn't let that happen to her. I wanted her to have some immortality. And this is the only way I could do it.
You know, you mentioned how she had attempted to write an autobiography at one point, and I really, really love the way you have incorporated her voice from those writings and her poetry and her prose into the story, into the book. Some of these notes, they were listed on all sorts of scrap paper?
They were. When I entered her apartment after she passed, and I started going through her things, and it was just a jumble of things, I thought, oh, she was a prolific writer. And I read some of the pages and I thought, oh, she could really write, but emotionally she couldn't get it together. Mm-hmm. So I said to my friend who had accompanied me to Hollywood, I said, I want every scrap of paper you can find with Myla's writing on it. And there were two garbage bags full of it. Oh, wow. And I found sometimes pages, they're all handwritten because, of course, she didn't have a computer, didn't know how to type. Right. And so I kept those. Some were in little booklets, some were on envelopes, some were on scraps of paper. One was in an envelope taped behind a picture frame. There were crumpled up paper notes in the pockets of old jackets and coats and purses. They were somewhere under the sofa, and they were just in drawers, in cupboards. They were all over the place, these little scraps of paper. And I sent them all home and then went through them and tried to make some sense of them.
Wow, what a puzzle.
It was. It was a giant jigsaw puzzle.
You know, I don't read very much fiction at all. And the trouble with biographies is that you invest all this time in them, you learn all about the person. And when it's over, of course, you get a sense of them. You know, you feel like you get a sense of them. And then, of course, the end result is that they die. I mean, that's the end of the story.
Yes.
And I guess there's always this bit of mourning that follows. And I have to say, Sandra, I am still in mourning because the book is so well written. It's such a great read. So two questions here. Have you ever written anything else?
No, never have.
And so who was your editor to help you with this?
Well, initially I had a friend in Finland who is a published author, and he made suggestions. He didn't really edit it. He made suggestions of what to add, nothing to remove. And that really helped a lot. And then when I found my publisher, Feral House, they had an editor who went through it and edited the final draft or the final copy.
Now, you saw your aunt Myla, I believe it was three times as a child, once again for a week years later as an adult. What's this connection that fueled your desire and drive to write this book?
Well, I think it began when I was a child. The first time I remember seeing her, I was five. We were in Los Angeles, and here was this goddess standing in front of me, and they said she was my father's sister. And she was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen, coming from tiny town Astoria, Oregon. Mm-hmm. I'd never seen a woman with blonde hair and blue eyeshadow from lashes to eyebrows and bright red lipstick, a gold lamé dress in the middle of the afternoon, and transparent heels, which I interpreted as glass slippers. So she became my own private Cinderella. And from then on, I kept asking my father, you know, who is my Aunt Myla? And, you know, he didn't talk much about his childhood because it was so sad.
Yeah.
And my grandmother would come from Los Angeles and stay with us in Astoria, Oregon over the summer and babysit me. And she always was complaining incessantly about Myla. You know, she's not writing to me. She's not answering my phone calls. I have to get back to Los Angeles and find out what's going on, because she worried all the time about her rebel daughter. And then I didn't see her again until my grandmother died in 57 when I was 10. And Myla, you know, she looked completely different, no makeup, and she wore the same clothing for 3 days in a row. The whole time we were there, she never changed her clothes. And the only thing she did for the funeral was she had taken this man-sized navy blue cardigan and put it on backwards for her mother's funeral, inside out. And now I know she was saying to the world, my life has been turned inside out. But then I didn't see her again until 1989. And I couldn't find her because this was before, this was pre-computer days. And I would call information to Los Angeles all the time looking for Myla Normi or Libby Nimi, because that was the name she used in high school. Every name that I had known her to have, and never could find her. I wrote to magazines, I wrote to television shows, I wrote to newspapers trying to find my Aunt Myla, and never could find her. In fact, when my father died in 1977, at the age of only 55, I could not find Myla to tell her her brother had passed, even with the help of the Red Cross. Little did I know, at that time, she was going under the alias of Helen Heaven. So she didn't find out her brother had passed until I saw her in 1989.
You mentioned your grandmother and you going to see Myla, of course, after the passing of the grandmother, and there's the funeral. And in the book, you describe this passage where Myla, I guess maybe your brother asks, you know, what happened or how she found your grandmother. And she like sort of just physically walks through exactly what had happened. And she ultimately sort of lands right in front of you in the room and has and breaks down. And did you say you were 10 at the time?
I was 10.
Wow. And that would have, as a 10-year-old, I would have been completely freaked out by that. So how did you deal with that?
Well, it took a moment for me to realize that she inched closer and closer to me, and she wasn't really looking at me. She was looking above my head. I was holding one of her cats.
Yeah.
And when she got right up to me, she you know, she screamed that famous vampire scream.
Oh my God.
And I leaped from the chair as the cat scratched my arm and ran out the door and down the sidewalk. And then I don't know what happened inside the house. I know my mother came outside looking for me and found me in the backyard of the place I had come back and was. I remember I was in the backyard of this apartment house, Myla's apartment house, looking through this wooden fence, and there were spaces between the pickets, and I could hear voices, and I looked through there, and there was a swimming pool next door, and people were in the swimming pool laughing, and I thought, oh, the world is normal after all. It's not crazy like it is in that house.
Yeah.
And then I came in, and you know, my mother fixed my arm, and we continued on
our little fairy tale tonight. Called the 13th guest. The 13 makes it timely, topical, and terrifying. It's about a humorous fellow who dies telling a joke. Something of a deadpan comedian. Here. Let me darken the room, and we shall commence.
Well, we remember your aunt mainly for this vampire persona, and that's that story alone is captivating enough, but she also had this uncanny ability or luck of being with, having friendships, making connections with some of the biggest and coolest pop culture icons of the early mid-20th century. I mean, Orson Welles, Mae West, Marlon Brando, James Dean, Anthony Perkins, the King, Elvis Presley. How often did your jaw drop open as you found out about these connections and these relationships as you were putting this together?
Well, I knew about James Dean from my grandmother. I can remember her writing and or calling or something and hearing that Myla is mooning over that kid that got killed in a car wreck. And I knew about the her favorite song, Rosemary Clooney's Hey There, because my grandmother complained about it, hearing it day and night. So I knew that as a child. I knew that she knew Orson Welles, but I didn't know anything much else about him until I talked to Myla. Anthony Perkins, let's see. I didn't know about him either. And Elvis, I was shocked when she told me about Elvis in 1989. I mean, my jaw must have hit the floor. Myla, you dated Elvis Presley. You know, whatever you did with Elvis.
We'll get to that later because, you know, and it has also a ties into to the hound dog. But Myla, first she arrives in Hollywood, I guess the first time it's 1941, and I believe she's 19. And we're now in this age of Me Too and Harvey Weinstein, these crimes, you know, come to light. I always knew that the golden age of Hollywood was rife with young women being taken advantage of. But wow, I mean, yeah. It just seems like from the top down, from those in power who should have known better to those of the lowest rungs who should have known better. There's all this taking advantage of these young women. Were you shocked by any of these revelations as you were putting the book together?
Gosh, I never thought about that. I probably felt badly for Myla, thinking, oh, it was such a different time. How horrible this must have been. I know that I was young in the 60s and in the early 70s. And, you know, men took advantage of women even then. But I think it was even worse for the women of Myla's generation. Yeah. And it was just accepted. You know, no one would believe a woman's story, and even if they did, well, so what? That's what men do, you know, and they were given a pass. So it was bad. It could have been much worse for Myla, but it was bad enough.
So I live here in Los Angeles, but I'm not here from originally. And I have to say that I got such a kick out of reading about places that I just happened to have frequented here when they pop up in your book. I ate a number of times at Clifton's Cafeteria before it became remodeled. I'm a big fan of a longtime restaurant, Musso Frank. They celebrated their like 100-year anniversary in 2019. And of the latter, Musso Frank, if you go in there and you ask, I mean, they'll point out where Raymond Chandler used to sit and where Charlie Chaplin held court, and also Orson Welles' booth.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the next time you come to town, ask them and they'll say, well, this is where he would hold court, right? And so in your book, when you speak of their initial meeting and her going over to him and he's in this booth, I mean, in my mind, I'm like, oh, I know exactly where they're standing, assuming he was in his proper booth, you know?
Yes.
And their relationship results in the birth of your cousin that you were alluded to earlier. And this is David Putter, right?
Yes.
Now, he was put up for adoption. I mean, how is he doing?
Oh, I've never met him personally yet because of COVID, but he's doing very well. He lives in a very tiny community with his significant other, Judy, who's a delightful woman. Two dogs and a cat. Big animal lovers. David was a revered and esteemed an attorney for 50 years. He was even the assistant attorney general of the state in his youth. So he had a storied career, but he's retired now, and I cannot wait to meet him. I'm the first family member he will ever meet.
What does he think about the book?
Oh, he's in love with it. Of course, it's his mother's story. You know, the first time I met him or talked to him on the phone, and he asked who his mother was, and I said, well, you better sit down. And I told him, and he said, oh, my God, I've waited 75 years to find out who my mother is. And then I find out she's a vampire. Racked up. He's very funny. He's got his mother's wicked sense of humor. And I see his mother in him very much so.
You did a some type of DNA test, and you confirmed his relationship with you. Now, there's something, I don't know whether it was in the book or whether it was in this, maybe a press release of some sort, but he or you or both of you have reached out to the Wells family about trying to get some kind of test done in the future?
Yes. Apparently, David is in contact with, I don't know, a representative mm-hmm. of one of the surviving Orson's daughters. Yeah. And I haven't heard back yet. I don't know. The last I heard, she was open to a DNA test, but none have been taken yet.
So how old was he when Myla told Orson about the birth?
Oh, gosh. I'm just guessing when she told Orson about the birth. Let's see, she met Dean or Dink in 1949. David was born in 1944. So I'm saying that David was probably only about two at the oldest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because he was born in March of 44.
So can you remind me whether she and Orson Welles kept in contact after that? That was revealed. That was basically it, right? They didn't.
That was, yeah, they had a final fight in New York City.
Yeah.
When she had gone with Orson to New York, and she showed up on her mother and father's doorstep in the middle of the night. They didn't even know she was in New York. And that was it. That was the final blowout. And she never spoke to Orson again, other than she saw him once as she was in 1956 when she was going to appear with Liberace at the Riviera in Las Vegas. He was just leaving and she was going to appear.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the last she saw of Orson.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Orson Welles. I'm speaking for the Mercury Theater, and what follows is supposed to advertise our first motion picture. Citizen Kane is the title, and we hope it can correctly be called a coming attraction.
Now, her mother, your grandmother, confronted Orson Welles.
Oh, yeah.
Right, and she's certainly she was a force to be reckoned with. I wasn't able to watch the whole documentary yet, but this Vampire and Me, there's an audio clip in there of Myla saying all she ever wanted was her mother's approval. Yeah. That reminded me about an early passage in your book, a scene where Myla's like reciting something in the kitchen, and your brother's kind of cutting up. You know, so she wants her mother's approval, yet her grandmother seemed to work so hard for your aunt. You mentioned her being concerned, complaining about Myla. Can you describe their relationship?
Well, it was contentious at times. When my grandmother was drinking and Myla was an adult, they didn't live together. It was only after my grandmother quit drinking 5 years before her death, never touched another drop, that they at times lived together. In fact, they were living together when my grandmother died. But it was contentious because my grandmother wanted nothing more than for Myla to find her husband, her the perfect man who would go to work every day, and Myla would be this happy little housewife and raising children, cooking and cleaning. And that was exactly what Myla despised. She never wanted anything to do with that. She wanted to be a free spirit and to be surrounded by other artistes like herself. Freedom, like she said, was my vitamin. And so they were always at loggerheads about that. Myla would go out, like the last letter that my grandmother ever wrote, you know, Myla spends all of her money on treating her friends out for dinner and taxis. And I'm left alone with, you know, having to drag myself to the grocery store to buy food for her cats. And so, you know, they didn't get along. Milo would sleep all day while her mother was at work, and then get up and when my grandmother was home and sleeping, she would stay out. So they didn't see a lot of each other. But Milo loved her mother. She depended upon her. They were codependents.
Yeah.
And it was often contentious. But her death destroyed Milo. It really did.
You write about Milo's father being selfish or performing selfish actions, like going off to Finland for a year, pretty much abandoning the family when she was a child.
Yeah.
Eventually, he divorces Milo's mother. So I want to compare or ask you, how does his selfishness compare with Milo's selfishness? And and how much selfishness does an artist require?
How much selfishness? Well, there has to be some selfishness, I suppose, when an artist has to be free to create. They don't often have time for family because their art comes first and always will. And I use, for an example, Orson Welles, who his previous wives always said, you know, he was never around. He was always involved with movie making. And I think Milo was always, you know, needing space, personal space, mm-hmm. to be who she wanted to be and to create. Even when she was being a recluse, what was she doing? But she was writing those pages and pages that I found. You know, she didn't have electricity. If she wrote at night, she had to write by candlelight. I don't know. Yeah, an artist needs a lot of freedom, a lot of space, and marriage doesn't fit into that. It just doesn't. I don't know. Yeah, children, no. I feel sorry for people, celebrities who have children. They don't have time for them. They hire people to take care of them.
Yeah. You know, her father was also never one to hold back from telling her how to run her life, what she needed to do. But he didn't chastise her about her pregnancy.
No.
Why was that?
I think because, well, he was in denial, I think.
Okay.
And also he felt he was warranted to ignore it because that was women's business. It wasn't anything to do with what he could do. You know, it was up to the mother to take care of the pregnant daughter, not him. That wasn't men's work. That was women's work. So he just went about his business as if everything was normal. And therefore, he could avoid any decisions or thinkings about what to do.
You know, I wasn't actually, I thought this was a very revealing thing. So he publicly to her, or directed towards her, he's always disapproving of her. And yet there's, he writes, I believe, to your father at some point that he's always collected her clippings, or maybe this is in a newspaper article where, you know, he's interviewed and that he always has collected her clippings.
Yes.
So obviously he was proud of her. You know, he was proud of her. I mean, when he dies, I mean, it's been years and years and years where they have had absolutely no contact. Is that correct?
They had exchanged a few letters, according to him. Once in a while, Milo would write to him, and he would write back.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, she had some interesting adventures working in a carnival. She's also the first male bellhop, or bellhop, B-E-L-L-E, hop, working in a hotel in New York. She's a becomes a columnist for Hobo News. She develops these characters like Darlene Dietrich and Countess Cuckoo. And while in New York City, there's also this first fling with Marlon Brando. She's in this Mae West show. She befriends this columnist, Irving Hoffman. And what's interesting to me about this guy, he's the guy that is responsible for her return to Hollywood and getting hooked up with director Howard Hawks. How does she come in contact with Hoffman?
Oh, gosh. You know, I'm trying to remember that. It may have been when she was working for the Hobo News and frequenting that bar. I can't remember the name of it, whether it was Walter Winchell and Irving Hoffman, I think, may have been one of the customers. And there was another. I can't think of his name now. But he was a famous writer also.
Yeah, but the thing about Hoffman to me is he seems to genuinely help her. And with a lot of these other men, you know, that she would come across, they would also be hoping to have some sort of romantic interlude with her. But he just seems to help her.
Yes, yes. And I found a few letters from Irving Hoffman that she had saved in her apartment, and I have them today. So I know their friendship extended beyond the years she was in New York. So I treasure those.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking for a good mystery on something off the beaten track like the Maltese Falcon.
Well, that was a fascinating story. But here's one that has everything the Falcon had and more. It's Raymond Chandler's latest bestseller, The Big Sleep. What a picture that'll make.
Mind if I look at it?
It's because of his write-up about her her performance that Howard Hawks winds up, you know, making overtures. And so Myla goes out to Hollywood. Was Hawks really grooming her to be the next Lauren Bacall?
Well, I think he was, because he even had a vehicle for her. He had a movie that was written by, is it his friend F. Scott Fitzgerald? They were good friends. Deathly Hallows, I think, was the name of the book that was going to be made into a film by Howard Hawks. And he had Myla in line for that part. But first he had to do the screen test and tell her that her teeth needed to be fixed, which they did. And Myla was extremely insulted by that. There was nothing wrong with her teeth as far as she could tell. And after 2 weeks, when she didn't hear back from Howard Hawks, that's when she flounced back into his office and tore up her contract and said goodbye to any movie career she may have had.
So I saw a pattern as I'm reading through the book. She seemed to have a hand in sabotaging her career a number of times.
Yes.
Now, What accounts for that? Is this some subconscious thing, or is it because she's so free-spirited, she's just in this moment? I mean, what do you think accounts for that behavior?
Well, first of all, let me say that Myla did come to terms with her own, with what she was doing to her career, because the title that she was going to call her autobiography, her first title, was How to Dig Your Own Grave with Your Teeth. So she was aware of it, at least in her older years, that what she had done. But I think Myla was insecure, I guess, about herself. And because growing up, she always felt terribly ugly and unattractive. And I think then when she became an adult, if anybody said she was less than perfect, well, then she had no use for that person. They must agree that she was a beautiful, attractive woman and talented. And if she got anything less of a response, well, then they were out the door. As when she was young, anyway, because she was just coming into her own beauty then. And to be told she was less than perfect, she couldn't abide by that. Plus, she thought she had the whole world in front of her. She had all of these opportunities, and she didn't need Howard Hawks. There were others who would want her just as she was. And, you know, she was only, what, 22? You know, when you're 22, you think a lot differently than when you're 42.
Yes, absolutely. I was going to ask you about some of her cheesecake pinup career, but she meets a former child actor and this writer, Dean Reisner, and he's the one that gives the name of her character, Vampire. He comes up with the actual name. They have a common law marriage. Was he her greatest love?
Boy, I have to say she had two great loves. She had Dean Reisner and she had Charles Beatles.
Okay.
Later on in life. But I think those two, well, Jimmy Dean, but she only loved him platonically. She was like a mother to him.
Right.
But two great loves, I would say, Dean and Chuck Beatles.
So it seems like, you know, she's still longing for him. He's losing interest in her. Did he ever have another wife or girlfriend that you know of?
He did. Yes, he married a woman named Marie. I don't know when that was. And they had no children. But it was a long time marriage.
Right. So I mentioned she starts doing some cheesecake and pinup work. And she's successful. She's on the cover of some magazines. But she's starting to age out of that. And then along comes this newfangled technology, television. How did she see TV and its implications, and why was it a perfect vehicle for her?
Well, it was a perfect vehicle for her because she had closed the door on every other opportunity. She couldn't work and she couldn't be on Broadway anymore, she thought, you know, and the movies were out. And Orson Welles was not going to train her as being the first female monologist, as she hoped. So there was not much left for her to do but television. And so she set her sights on that. She never gave up. She was very resourceful. And so that's why she wanted to be on television.
Well, tell us about the Bal Carib.
The Bal Carib. Okay, 1953, she found out from Rudy Gernreich, who was the inventor of the monokini, and a famous fashion designer and also a good friend of Myla's, that there was going to be this ball and there's going to be some Hollywood bigwigs there. And so if she wanted to be noticed, maybe that would be an opportunity for her to go. And it was a costume party. So Myla was very excited and planned to go. And of course, Dink would not escort her because he didn't want to go see a bunch of flaming homosexuals prance around in little or no costume, you know. So he said no, but he found her an escort and he gave her $10 to buy a costume. So Myla went and bought some fabric for, I don't know, $3.99 or something, black rayon from Home Silk, and she went and rented a wig from Max Factor, an Indian wig that they did for the movies. And she went home and she sewed the vampire dress. But she was going to go as Charles Adams' cartoon character, who did not have a name yet, but I will call her Morticia because later on, Adam's family, but she was going to go as Morticia, and Morticia was mute. So she dressed herself in the black dress and went barefoot and made her makeup look very, very pale, like she had been entombed. And she went with her escort, a little Scottishman who was a counterman at a restaurant. And they went to the Bal Carib, and wouldn't you know, they started having a contest to see who would win. And they had the contestants parade around in a circle. And Myla was down to the final two. There was Myla and then some gentlemen dressed in flashing lights, strategically placed, and they went around and around, and the audience was crying out, the vampire girl or something like that. I don't remember what they were calling out. And so Myla won the contest and she won a transistor radio, and then she disappeared. But in the audience that night, there was a man called Hunt Stromberg, and he was the program director for KATU, and he was desperate to find Myla, but nobody knew her name. He had in mind a late night show where they would show horror films, and they wanted a host to introduce each film. And it took him 5 months, but he found Myla, and he asked her to come in for an interview. And so Myla went in for an interview in March, the Ides of March, I think. And he told her what he wanted, you know, Charles Adams' character and blah, blah, blah. And Myla said, well, who are going to be the other family members? And he said, oh, well, we just want you. We don't have the money, you know, to hire anybody else. And Myla says, well, then I can't possibly do it because I'm not going to rip off Charles Adams. That isn't right. And he says, well, forget it. We're just not going to do it. She says, but what if I come up with something a little bit different than this costume? I could, you know, jazz it up. And he says, okay, you got 4 days. So she went home and she worked on her costume, added a few accoutrements. What she did is she padded her hips and she padded her bust line and she cinched in her already tiny waist to 17 inches with a black patent leather belt because she had been doing cheesecake. So she was very thin, changed her makeup up and went in dressed as Vampyra. And I would imagine Hunt Stromberg's jaw dropped to the floor when he saw her standing there with a long phallic cigarette holder and asking for a cigarette. And she was hired on the spot. In fact, that day they had her sign a contract. She was hired immediately.
A dragon lady. I should have known you'd be mixed up in something like this.
In Macau, I am Madame Roulette.
How'd I get here?
I had no choice, Golden One.
How do you mean?
So the other aspects to her character you mentioned is, you know, coming out of this sort of Morticia character, but it's also a part of the Dragon Lady and the Evil Queen.
Yes.
And the Evil Queen, you know, from Snow White. So now I had to look up the Dragon Lady. I was not familiar with this character whatsoever. Can you explain to folks who the Dragon Lady is and why this was such a character that stuck in Myla's mind?
Well, when Myla was a child, she was in the Sunday paper comic section. And Myla was fascinated her because it was the first female character she had ever seen that was powerful and in control and domineering and always seemed to have money. And so she thought, wow. A woman that's not cooking and cleaning and married, but she's powerful and men are afraid of her. That's who I want to be. That's who I don't want to be evil, but I want to be domineering and I want to be imperious. And that's who the Dragon Lady was.
So she's the first horror host. And her program debuts, let's see, May the 1st, 1954 in Los Angeles, KABC. It runs until she's fired the following year on April the 16th. So it's not on for quite a full year. And yet this local television show, and this is something that has to be stressed, I think, because you could only see it in Los Angeles. Nobody else in the nation could see this, but it gets all this amazing national press. She's in Life magazine. She's getting fan mail from all over the country, world, I believe. What accounts for how she was just so well known without people even being able to see the program?
Had to be Life magazine. I thought about that many times. I have no idea when it was only a local television station seen in the greater Los Angeles area, how she became a world phenomenon. I do not know to this day, other than she was featured in Life magazine. Life magazine had a huge following, and it had to be from there. She eventually went on TV Guide also, but it had to be just print. It had to just be print media.
So while the show was on the air, KABC starts another movie host program called Voluptua. And that doesn't last very long before religious figures and others worried about morality begin to lobby for his demise. The Vampyra is, you know, just as sexually charged. Why is she spared? What is it about a character that doesn't threaten the morality police?
Well, I think it's because Well, the time zone was terrible for Voluptua. It was, what, 9 to 10 o'clock at night when families, especially housewives, were still awake. And so they were incensed by this woman, you know, swaying all over her boudoir, you know, asking men to come visit her, and she couldn't wait breathlessly. It was just too much. So housewives inundated the station with letters to pull the plug on Voluptua. But Myla, you have to remember, she was on later. Mm-hmm. She was on from 11 to 12. And she was unapproachable, and she wasn't threatening to the housewives. It was, I think the housewives kind of thought, wow, she's something different. You know, our men wouldn't be, she doesn't want our men. Yeah. She doesn't want anybody. She doesn't need anybody. She's independent. She's powerful on her own. She was non-threatening to the average housewife. So I think that's why.
James Dean as Cal, the wildest boy you've ever met.
So while Vampire is airing, now is that when she meets James Dean?
Yes, she met him in August of 54. So yes, James Dean was a complete unknown. And Myla was at the pinnacle of her success. And they became fast friends. When Myla found out he'd lost his mother at age 9, and she had lost her son at birth, I think maybe unconsciously she became his mother. And we don't know if James thought of her as a mother, but she gave a lot of advice to him. Mm. And they formed a platonic relationship, and they were very close until his passing.
If I'm remembering this right, her favorite photo of him was one of him standing beside a hog. Why was that?
That was her favorite picture because, well, first it showed James Dean as she saw him, just an Indiana farm boy. Mm-hmm. He wasn't this famous actor at all. He was a farm boy. Very shy. Myla was always complaining that he was too frugal, that he was tight. That when Myla had lost her job and Dean had all of a sudden their career paths had completely switched. Now Myla was Who Are You? And James Dean was this rising superstar in Hollywood because his first movie had come out into the world, East of Eden.
Yeah.
And so then he became a famous movie star overnight. Anyway, so he got tired of Myla telling him that, you know, he only paid for his coffee at Googie's and he never left a tip. And she ended up having to pay Jack Simmons breakfast. And he had way more money than she had. And why was he so tight? And so he decided to take her on a date. And he went into Googie's and he picked her up on his motorcycle and he swiped ketchup and mustard from Googie's and told him he would return it in a while. And off they went on a motorcycle and went to a grocery store and he swiped everything there. He stole two hot dogs. He put the buns up Myla's sweater and told her to keep it there. I think he even stole a couple of drinks. Pops, soda pops on his way out the door. And then he drove her up to, can't remember the name of the park. But anyway, and found a secluded spot. And he had brought with him a old coffee can on a wire that he had hung on his handlebars. And he started a hobo stove up there. And they roasted wieners and used the buns and the ketchup and the mustard. And then for dessert, he pulled out of his jacket a package of marshmallows. And Myla said, "Oh my God, you stole those too? Your sleight of hand is very impressive." Anyway, they roasted the marshmallows and he was a goofball. He was only 24. Oh, before that, he was saying, "Do you know what hot dogs are made of?" And she said, "No, why?" And he says, "Well, they're made out of hog eyeballs," I think it was. And Myla said, "Oh, they're no." And then she thought, "Oh my God, they raise hogs. He raised hogs in Indiana. Maybe they are." Anyway, he laughed. He said, "No." But anyway, the marshmallows he squished on his eyeglasses, and he was blind as a bat without his glasses on. And he drove her back to Googie's with the ketchup and the mustard. And Milo was terrified because she knew he couldn't see anything because his glasses were all mucked up with marshmallow. But that's why her favorite picture is Jimmy with his hog, because of the story he told her on that hillside. That was probably one of her most prized memories, the time they were alone on that hillside.
That was Joan Jett giving us some of Riding with James Dean off her 1988 album Up Your Alley. Just prior to that, we heard Sandra Nemi tell us about her Aunt Myla's motorcycle ride with James Dean after their hobo date in Griffith Park here in Los Angeles. And that brings part one of our Coolest Conversations with Sandra to an end. Thanks to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast, and join me next week for part two, where we'll hear all about her relationship with Elvis, attempts to revive the Vampire Show, and a relationship with comedian Dana Gould. That's your next week's Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
There's a place in New York where you can walk through the actual front doors of the world's most famous recording studio, Abbey Road. Through those doors, past the Beatles, Pink Floyd, Radiohead, and countless other rock giants. Where can you find those doors? At the Hard Rock Cafe Times Square. The Abbey Road doors and thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock Cafes, Hard Rock Casinos, and Hard Rock Hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.